Blog Talk Radio.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle stations.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And good afternoon, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. And just a quick reminder for those that are joining us live, we already have a really good crowd up in the chat room. Just scroll to the bottom of the show page. You can pop right into the chat room there. That's a great place. If you have some observations about the show that you want to share, or you, if there's a question you would like for us to ask our guest, or perhaps a follow-up to something you have heard us talk about, that's a great place to put it in. Both Eagle One and myself will be in there and monitoring as the show goes on. And the usual suspects there will keep things going in case the conversation is not enough for you. And if you're new to Midrats and you want to catch up on some previous shows, or if you just want to listen to them at your leisure as opposed to coming in with us live, you can always go over to the show page of Blog Talk Radio and get the archive there, or just subscribe to the free podcast on iTunes. I also like to make the note now and then that the live show is a defined 60 minutes. At the 60-minute mark, it will end. Occasionally, we will go a few minutes over if our guest is in the course of answering a question. We don't want to knock them off. Or if there's just one more question that my co-host or I have to ask, then maybe we'll do it in the after show. And we'll let you know in the chat room if we are going over how much longer we do. You can just go in, grab the archive later, and you'll be up and running. So let's go ahead and get on with the show. Today, we're real excited to have our guest on board because I think it's a conversation we've touched on a few other shows, and now we're just going to dedicate some time to it because as we leave our land wars in Asia and look forward to the future and what maritime challenges that we need to meet, the conversation has to come, especially in a time where we know there's going to be additional budgetary stress on what size and kind of fleet the U.S. Navy will have. Is your fleet going to meet your strategy, or is your strategy going to have to meet your fleet? What are the major schools of thought right now on what direction that we should be heading our Navy and Marine Corps team towards? And what does history tell us about where we need to look? What are some good ways to look at the future? And what perhaps are some of the pratfalls you can come into? And for the full hour to discuss this and a whole lot more, will be Wayne P. Hughes, Jr., Captain, United States Navy, retired, in addition to being an author of many books and articles, including the Cornerstone 1986 Fleet Tactics Theory and Practice, and its update 13 years later, Fleet Tactics Update with Coastal Combat. He's also written many articles. He's a professor at the Department of Operations Research at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. And he has a great experience there, and a lot of our leaders have had the opportunity to sit in his classroom because Captain Hughes, he first received his MS in operational research from the Navy Postgraduate School in 1964. He returned in 1979 and continued as a civilian instructor for 32 years, including 5 years as Dean of the Graduate School of Operational Informational Services. He is a distinguished alumni of the Navy Postgraduate School. On active duty, he brought on board experience commanding a minesweeper, a destroyer, and he also directed a large training command. And ashore, he was deputy director of the CNO's Systems Analysis, Op 96, and also aide to Undersecretary of the Navy, R. James Woolsey. Captain Hughes, welcome to Midrats.
Thank you, Sal. I'm honored to be here.
And it's a great pleasure to have you on. Often you come up in positive ways, I assure you, in conversations that we've had on the show. So it really is great to have you here in person. And I wanted just to start the show off, just kind of define where you have dedicated so much of your life to. Is even inside the Navy, I don't think there's a good understanding over in Monterey what the Navy actually defines as operations research. what type of people go there to study operations research, and what are the topics that you study and work on in operations research out there at Monterey?
Well, let's start with who studies it. We have a large segment is naval officers, but we also have Army, occasionally an Air Force, a pretty good slug of internationals. So the course is unclassified, and to me that's an advantage because that means they bring a different slant, both in the operations research curriculum and in other curricula across the campus. Operations research started as a military subject, then expanded and became prolific in business and finance, transportation, all kinds of things. I would say that the military operations research curriculum we have here is number one in the world. I'd say we were one of the top 10 or 20 in operations research in general, and we do try and protect that reputation. As for me, I've been teaching mainly in the past 20 of my 30 years a campaign analysis course and advising a lot of thesis students. And I will brag on one thing, which is one of my thesis students was Mike Mullen. And another one was the senior woman in the Navy, Patricia Tracy. In fact, she was my very first thesis student. I've had a few notables, but those will give you a flavor of the kinds of people that I've had the privilege of advising.
Captain Hughes, you recently came out, or you had a team that came up with a new piece of work called the New Navy Fighting Machine, and the title based on Bradley Fisk's The Navy Has a Fighting Machine. One of the questions he poses in the preface to that is, what is the Navy for? And I think the second question is, and what should it be composed of? Can you kind of talk about that in light of the New Navy Fighting Machine?
You betcha. The New Navy Fighting Machine came out in the latter part of about 5 years ago. There was at least a decade of history before that. I wrote an essay back in 2007 called something about a bimodal Navy. It's in the spring issue of 2007, I think. And that refers to a long history of different perspectives on what the Navy was for. It touts and emphasizes a national maritime strategy as what ought to be warp and woof of our own strategy. And I've thought that what I didn't do in that article was actually spell out what the composition of the fleet ought to be in the 21st century. One could infer that because I talk a lot about two polar opposites. One was to influence China and keep our allies in East Asia, as because we could see even from 2000 on, if not before, that China was going to be formidable at sea, and we needed to be able to work with that. The other was to continue to deal with small contingencies around the world. And to read the essay, one might think that we were, because we were talking about what we had been doing for so long, that is to say, dealing with situations like Grenada, Somalia, Lebanon, and to a lesser extent, although they were big in terms of time and investment, Vietnam and Korea and more recently Iraq and Afghanistan. But the small wars end of the spectrum and the medium wars at the end of the spectrum, one might think, should dominate the composition of the Navy. And I said, on the contrary, that wasn't so. The second piece that led to the New Navy Fighting Machine was the cooperative strategy for the 21st century that you mentioned Barney Rubel. He had a great deal to do with, and And that, in my recollection, about 80% of the effort or writing was dealt with preventing wars, humanitarian assistance, and one might conclude then, therefore, that the intent of the cooperative strategy was to have a large proportion of the fleet invested in that, and I think that was one of the things that turned off a lot of people when they first read the strategy. Point being that I thought we needed to talk about the composition of the fleet, and my going-in position was that at most 10% of the SDN budget should be devoted to the small wars end, the green water end of the fleet, and 80% should be invested in the blue water side. That's a better way of saying it than 80% for China and 20% for the rest of the world. It doesn't break down that way. There's a missing 10% here, and that has to do with the strategic the strategic deterrent or strategic war composition, and that's a separate part of this. But let me pause here, and that's the background for the Nunez fighting machine, in which with 10% of the budget, about 240 ships of the 600-plus ships in the fleet composition, that was what we were able to produce, plus 400 for inshore and riverine combatant, 240 plus 400 little guys for riverine and inshore combatant combat. And then the 80% comprised about 400, a little over 400 ships. I must hasten to say, before I go back to you, that that was a $15 billion a year SDN budget. Not sure we're going to be able to make $15 billion, but I think we should, because I think the with the National Maritime Strategy, the Navy is the kingpin in the any strategy that we have for the next 20 or 30 years. So I'd like to hope for that much. I know the 313 ship Navy can't be built for $15 billion, so at least we are struggling to figure out what we can have for. Yeah, I hate to think we'd go below $12 billion. If you get down to $9 billion, you have to have a whole new attitude, configuration, almost a whole new strategy. But at $12 billion, you can scale back. At $15 billion, you can have 600 ships with a robust blue water navy and a lot of ships for green water operations.
There are some people out there, and I don't agree with them because I think they're just an intellectual shortcut. But some people have talked about it, you know, going back to the 70s and the high-low mix. But it's really a lot different than that. And I think it's you see as part of the conversation you have, and I know he's real proud of the legs it has. But you have Captain Jerry Hendricks, Ford's not Ferraris. You have the CNO's more recent platforms versus payloads. And a couple of months ago, over at The Economist, they had a great visual that kind of built off of those two concepts that I think you can directly trace back to the discussions of the new Navy fighting machine, where it had a semi-tractor with wings on it, talking about the what's more important is what you're putting in the truck as opposed to building the truck. And it's really looking towards discussing what type of fleet balance you've had, because you brought up in one of your writings that there's a misconception that a very large multi-purpose ship is actually useful for a lot of things. So it's big, it's multi-useful, so it's very handy. But that's really not true when you're looking at carrying out specific missions, and those big multi-mission ships might actually be a negative economy. Could you talk a little bit about that, how the bigger may not be better?
Yes, indeed, and I have to do a little sorting here to get at it. The multi-purpose, the zinger, if there's a slogan here, the problem with multi-purpose ships is if you lose the ship performing one mission, then you lose it performing all missions. So that's the biggest and most troublesome. Even LCS, with its modules, envisage it performing the ASW mission and being put out of action, and then it's lost for its other purposes as well. The Aegis ships we depend on them for ASW, we depend on them for naval gunfire support, and it seems clear as a bell that an Aegis ship is not one that you want to send in 10 miles off the enemy coast to do naval gunfire support, so it wouldn't be attractive for that mission. That's the second concern I have. The third is that multi-purpose ships by nature are strong for long at-sea time, so we have to build endurance into them. We pride ourselves on the endurance that we can build into our big ships, our aircraft carriers. Nuclear-powered gives them virtually infinite endurance. So we have to put avgas in the aircraft. Big aircraft carriers are very flexible and adaptable, but they also are so valuable that we have to be careful about where we put them at risk. All of those things mean that when one of those ships is we put a big investment into the endurance. If you go more single mission oriented in the green water component of the Navy for inshore ASW, for inshore minesweeping, for the cleaning out the clutter of the enemy, and especially dealing with his swarms of small combatants. If you do that, then you will want to home port those single mission ships, smaller and more numerous, and arrange for new ways of supporting them. But on the other hand, they're all combat, and they don't have to invest in a considerable amount of money to keep them going and giving them the long legs and endurance, if that makes sense.
Well, that makes sense. I mean, the way I read the new Navy fighting machine was that we've got a blue water fleet that takes care of the sea control aspect of trying to handle that. And then you're talking about a much more specific force to handle those littoral and coastal combat areas. Am I on the right track with that? And can you discuss a little bit along with that the lighter carriers, the smaller, the CLs or CVLs or whatever it is that you call them instead of the CVNs?
The CVN is the most efficient deliverer of air power because it can be proximate to a location, and it was really, really valuable for Iraq, for Iran. It was invaluable as long as the Sixth Fleet was operating in numbers in the Mediterranean. But sometimes you don't need that much capability. Take Desert Storm. It was good to have several carriers there until the Air Force established its bases and built up its own capability. You could say the same thing for Operation Iraqi Freedom as well. After, especially with OIF, which went on for so long, we didn't need CVNs there anymore. A CVL would have been able to provide the air surveillance that the Air Force didn't have or that the Navy was uniquely equipped to provide. I think that there... my friend Jeff Klein had a son who spent a lot of time burning holes in the air over Iraq, taking pictures of some of the Babylon. I remember he sent back a picture of the ruins of Babylon. he just was not that busy. The point being that there are times when you need a big 75 aircraft's worth of a flight deck, but there are other times when 10 or 20 aircraft's worth of combat aircraft will do the trick. So the CVL was my way of keeping the numbers up. In the new Navy fighting machine, for example, we reduced the CVNs from 11 to 6, but we ended up with 28 air-capable ships with 18 CVLs, and then we also maintained a pretty good number of LHAs and LHDs, which are another alternative to a CVL. I liked CVLs because they were single mission capable. They were focused on one thing, and that was delivering air power, surveillance and strikes, and support of operations ashore. The LHA with its Marines on board and a mixture of helicopters and landing craft was more mission capable, but on the other hand, gets me back to the limitations of multi-mission ships. And because they were 40,000 tons and pretty expensive, I thought CVLs as an alternative to CVNs and LHAs made a lot of sense.
Kevin Hughes, I wanted to back up a little bit. Something that you brought up in one of your answers that is something I find really intriguing, because for the last decade plus, we've had really very fat defense budgets. But you talked about, you know, the SDN, $15 billion, $12 billion, then you reached $9 billion, you really got to kind of rejigger your thoughts. And especially our European allies, they, because of the budgetary stresses that we're just now starting to come terms to, a lot of those navies are well into a decade of very austere shipbuilding accounts and force reductions. But even some of the smaller navies and nations, you know, between 5 million and 20 million, have produced some interesting platforms, from the Swedish Visby up to the Dutch Seven Provinces, Norwegian Nansen, the Danish Absalon. When you look at how those nations have responded to their fleet composition inside of their significantly reduced budgetary allotments, do you see a Navy that our nation has done a good job trying to match their fleet capabilities to their national strategies, even though obviously for smaller nations is much different than ours? And are any of those platforms they've developed in the last 15, 20 years you find the most impressive?
I'm not going to talk about which are the most impressive, but I will tell you that their designs are impressive, and we should be studying at their feet when we start building an inshore combatant, which I think is ought to be in our plans for the future. Their problem is solvable so long as they are operating off their own coast. They have to struggle when they start talking about supporting operations, as some of them would like to do, overseas. And in fact, they pretty much have to depend upon us to get them there and to provide air reconnaissance, surveillance, and that sort of thing. They have a big problem with deployability, but they have lovely capabilities when they combine land-based air for surveillance with a capability that is deadly for inshore combatant. I'm going to pause, but I want to come back to talking about what I think would be an important part of the future Navy, and that is a flotilla of missile ships for inshore combat.
Absolutely.
All right. Now we get into shifting from the fleet that had a green water component, a blue water component, and a strategic warfare component to the purpose of that fleet. And then we go back to the bimodal nature of it, and let's concentrate on China for a minute. We did a workshop here that has had a lot of student interest, and one of the reasons that I can talk about we can gracefully reduce from a 15 billion SCN per year to 12 billion SCN per year, but we have to struggle with a 9 billion SCN per year, is because a group of students in another class looked at that, and I got to tell you, they were international students, and it was very gratifying to see the contribution they made in saying, look, we're not so impressed with big, huge ships. We think that little deadly ships that can come to our aid in our own waters is just as valuable or more so than 100,000-ton CVNs. Be that as it may, when we were looking at China, we started with what I think is starting to happen. I think the Admiral Greenert and certainly Jerry Hendricks and probably others are starting to see that the first key element of a strategy with China is submarines that can go into their own home waters, that is to say the East China Sea and the South China Sea and a little bit of the Yellow Sea, and deny them the use of their own waters. That, to me, has just enormous leverage in keeping the peace, not in having to do it, but in showing that we can create what T.X. Hammis calls offshore control, and we've here alternately called a war at sea strategy or a no man's land strategy to temper Chinese ambitions and keep the peace and keep the competition peaceful, as opposed to what they've been dabbling with now at the Senkakus and off Vietnam and in the Spratlys and the Paracels. So that's the first element. The second element is a variety of ways that we could show them that their commercial traffic and their energy imports are subject to our interference, anywhere from an occasional stoppage, if that's a minimum indicator of our taking their illegal and improper claims on the South China Sea and bullying in the South China Sea and the East China Sea, all the way up to a full-blown blockade if it came to that. There's a whole menu of different levels of maritime interdiction that we could impose, some of them being quarantine-like, some of them being belligerent acts blockade is a belligerent act, for example. The third and more recent element of this capability comes in the form of small combatants, and just for illustrative purposes, maybe about 500 tons, maybe with 8 missiles, armed to the teeth. We have models of designs here at the postgraduate school, a Sealant study we did for Admiral Zabrowski back in the year 2000. But all of the designs that other nations have attracted you to, like Bisbee's and the new La Combattante, the whole series of SAR vessels that the Israelis have. All of these are good models for us to emulate, and we don't need to start from scratch. We need to get back, and if we don't call them Street Fighters, we need to call them Sea Lances. I've been calling them Cushings lately because William B. Cushing was such a hero of mine, and there have been 5 different warships called Cushings, but Cushings of 500 tons that look very deadly, and we need some to confront the Chinese directly as opposed to the more asymmetric strategies represented by the threat of our submarines sinking ships in their China seas or imposing a distant blockade, because the maritime interdiction effort has to be in choke points like the Sunda Straits and the Malacca Straits and the Singapore Straits. So that's a third component in a strategy which I think would keep China tempered in their ambitions to go to sea. It's pretty evident that they understand they need a sea-controlled navy. Sea denial and area denial are not enough for them, and they can't continue to depend upon us to protect themselves at sea. And so the competition at sea is the competition I want to foster, because I think we will win it, and affordably so.
One of your new projects, I understand, is an international center for littoral operations. Could you discuss that a little bit?
Oh boy, I'm glad you asked. The international connection is because Swedish industry, Saab, with its American affiliate Sensus, came to us and said, "We think there ought to be some collaboration. We're involved in the littoral combat ship. We provide some of a big part of the equipment, the information technology, in one of the versions. And we see that there's going to be changes in progress, and so we jumped on that and we said yes, let's collaborate on that. Went back and had a gathering of Navy people in Washington who were enthused, came back, and we've just stood up this International Center for Littoral Operations study and instruction. We're unique, the only place in the world I think of that can do this, because we have science and technology in our portfolio, we have operations research in our portfolio, and yet we can affiliate with the business world, both domestic and international, and I think it's a really powerful way to hasten the next generation, which I would like to see. We're going to build 24 LCSs, but I think we need to get on with the next generation of inshore combatants, as well as change some of the features as new opportunities come along to improve the LCS, of which we're going to have 24, and I think 24 is a pretty good number to have, but I think the 55 or 65 is not a pretty good number, that we need a second generation of inshore combatant, and also of a new generation of blue water ship. LCS is sort of a bad compromise right now. It goes too fast and has too short legs to be a good replacement for FFGs and for Spruance classes. We need something like a modern, heavily missile-armed ship that doesn't invest in the highly expensive Aegis capability, whether it is for BMD or for cruise missiles. So we need to split the LCS and into two versions, a blue water version that would be the FFG replacements, and an inshore version that looks and is deadly as a missile combatant.
Well, Kevin, that's a great lead-in to one of the questions I wanted to bring up to you. Is I was a big fan of the old phrase, you know, build a little, test a little, learn a lot. And it just seemed with LCS, where everybody just seemed to be really borelocked on, you know, we're going to build 55 exactly like this, that we're going to build a lot, test not so much, and learn if we can. Is there been a shift towards what you were just discussing, which is, you know, let's take an intellectual operational pause, so to speak, and try to take on board what we've learned so far with what we've built and decide whether we need to stop, change, and pivot, or is there still a lot of institutional inertia like we've seen for the last half decade that we're going to have 55 and we think we know exactly what it's going to be like?
I don't know the answer to that, but I know the man for you to go talk to, and that's Admiral Tom Roden, who has the Surface Navy program. His dad was my classmate, Bill Roden, and Tom is really good. I don't know how much he can say, because after all, he's there in Washington, where you sort of live in this constrained environment, but Tom's a very smart guy. Let me tell you what I think his answer ought to be, which is, you're absolutely right. The blame falls on guys like us, systems analysts, who claimed we could design on paper a perfect ship before we built the first one, and then we could build 30 of them or 50 of them, and it just ain't so. We built the Spruances, and the one thing we did do is make them big enough that we could modify them, add to them. The first Spruance was 8,100 tons. The USS Cushing, which my friend Captain Jeff Klein commanded out of Yokosuka, was 9,800 tons, because we added stuff to it, lethal stuff and some defensive stuff. The Aegis ship was the CG was actually easier to build, because it was a descendant of the Bruins class hull. Be that as it may, if we got it right, we would know that the first edition of anything was going to need to be modified. But if you have a contract, as we did with the Spruance, to build a whole series of them, and then we find out we need to change them, then that costs money, and that's kind of the way the shipbuilding industry makes money, not with the original contract, but with the changes. My model of successful development was the treaty cruisers. If you look back at the Pensacola and the Salt Lake City, designed in 1929, or maybe commissioned in 1929, they were thought to be not very good designs. They had 10 instead of, they had four turrets instead of three for their 8-inch guns. They were top heavy. They rolled and wallowed, and they didn't have much armor. We went through four generations of improvements, and then we got to the Astoria class, and we thought they were really, really the cat's pajamas. And they also were a model for the wartime Cleveland and Baltimore classes. We only built seven of the Astorias, and there were only two Pensacolas and only two Indianapolises. What we found out, however, when the war started, the Pensacola and the Salt Lake City had just as much combat action as the Astorias, and they both survived the war, and we blew them up at Bikini. The Astorias, we lost three of them in about 15 minutes in the first night battle at Guadalcanal. My own judgment is the Pensacolas, which we thought were dogs, were probably 80% as good as the Astorias, but they in combat, that the luck of the draw, an 80% ship may be good enough to fight and survive. So that's what I want to do with LCS. I'd like to progress it, and in general, I think the image that you hold, which is to not try and design things perfectly the first time, and then defend them and program a lot of them, it just doesn't work. It's much better to build a few, have contracts for maybe 2 to 8, and then negotiate a new and better contract. But ask Tom Roden.
One of our listeners, Kevin Hughes, has asked a good question. Are the Chinese learning more from U.S. ideas, Street Fighter, Mahan, et cetera, than we are?
Well, I think so. The Sea Lance was a Street Fighter design, a wave piercing catamaran, had four harpoons, had 50, count them, short range, dual purpose, surface to surface, surface to air, had a little gun, all on 600 tons. Wave piercing catamaran hull, though, is what the Hubeis have. They're only 250 tons, but they sure do look like they stole that design from the Sea Lance. That's example number one. Another one is salvo equations are very handy for reaching generic conclusions about the advantage of big ships versus small ships, and especially the advantage of numbers being dominant. Well, there are two Chinese articles in the literature. Both of them are descendants of the salvo equations. One of them extends the salvo equations. The other one takes off from references a work by Lieutenant Casey Mahan, who wanted to look at whether, using the salvo equations, whether it wouldn't be advantageous, whether ships could not be more easily exposed to shore attacks now. You know, there's a great old aphorism which says a ship's a fool to fight a fort. The modern fort is land-based missiles and land-based aircraft. So Casey Mahan's theory was that we could more easily go into these dreadful waters. He was actually thinking more of Iran than he was of China, but it would be easier to do that because we could now shoot down the attackers, and we also had precision guidance munitions. And he thought he proved his point. I thought, well, you did, but you know, we're still losing a lot of ships, and I'm not sure how many ships we want to lose. But the Chinese took that and republished it, and you can't help thinking that they did this because they were interested, from their perspective, on the effectiveness of anti-access area denial, their anti-access area denial capability on us. Point being, yeah, I think the Chinese are reading everything we write and profiting from it.
Kind of a similar take of sometimes not learning our own lessons. I wanted to get your take on one of my little bugbears for the last few years, and I think it's great what you and others have brought and continue to bring up the conversation about green water, brown water coming up close to shore, because sometimes people dismiss. If you bring up, you know, hey, off Normandy, the destroyers dropped anchors within a two iron shot of shore. It's like, well, that was World War II. But, you know, even more recent history, you know, the Falkland Islands, San Carlos water, the invasion of Iraq, you know, 5-inch Friday when you had the five ships go up with their 5-inch guns off the Alfaw Peninsula and did the Lord's work there. And even today, and what we've seen the last couple of years, where everybody talks about precision strike in urban environments, the Israeli gunboats with their outstanding combination of missile, and I believe it's a 30-millimeter, have really been able to do some precision strikes in Gaza. Got the video, very impressive stuff. But we seem to always have to fight and claw to get that in appreciation. Is a lot of that have to do with the way that we promote and incentivize our officers in a similar manner to the battleship mafia we saw before World War II, that just because the perverse incentives that we have of what you need to do to get promoted, that a lot of people that have that background and understand the nuance and the second and order, third order effects of different platforms, they don't make it simply because they're not in the approved community, so to speak, as they move up the chain of command.
Well, here's a sort of a yes and no. Our students are lieutenants in the main, and I've talked to a zillion of them, and they all think that they would love to. I commanded my minesweeper as a junior lieutenant. Jeff Klein commanded his PHM as a junior lieutenant commander. We thought this was a cat's pajamas. In fact, that minesweeper command kept me in the Navy. I was not going to leave the Navy after having commanded a ship until I had my destroyer. And then after the destroyer, all I want to do is have a cruiser or a destroyer division. Be that as it may, this generation of officer are hot to trot in having command of something like a 500-ton deadly missile ship, and they would be more than happy to take it in harm's way. Young officers think they're immortal anyway, but I don't think there is any inhibition from the future Navy, and in fact, it would enhance recruitment. Okay, that's one side of the story. So how do we get there? I've thought about this an awful lot, probably for 10 years, and when I saw the Naval Expeditionary Combat Command, I thought, now we have a vehicle. It was created by Mike Mullen to work in Brownwater in the Riverine Force, but it also was I had a lot of cats and dogs associated with it, and now it's gone offshore, but they're all still small ships. Bottom line, a small craft. Bottom line, if we put a senior, experienced, aggressive admiral in command of it and told him his mission was to build up a green water fleet, we'd be off and running. Anything less than that, the analog is naval aviation with Admiral Moffat. We didn't know how air was going to go in the Navy. All we knew was we didn't want Billy Mitchell to have a centralized air force and take our aircraft away from us. So Mitchell worked with dirigibles. He worked with, as long as he lived, he worked with dive bombers, torpedo bombers, fighters, and he, along with people in the fleet like Admiral Reeves, by the time we got to World War II, we knew where we were going. We weren't quite there yet, but we knew where we were going. And a lot of those people knew that air power was going to dominate the battleship Navy. I don't think that the Green Water Navy is going to dominate the Blue Water Navy by any means, but I do think we need a champion who understands the big picture and is close to the CNO and Navy leadership who can build on, you mentioned the foreign navies, can build on foreign navies, steal from them, learn their tactics, learn their techniques, and make the Navy aware that this part of the fleet is a vital part, even though my estimate is it will only take 2 or 3% of the Navy SCN budget.
One of the aspects of the new Navy fighting machine that I thought was interesting was your discussion or the discussion of your group on the air independent submarines. Can you discuss that a little bit?
No doubt in my mind that we need for China. We've done a few campaign analyses looking at the mix up of sub on surface. The whole idea of creating a no man's land in the China Seas, and I don't think 35 or 40 SSNs is enough. So as long as the U.S. Navy feels like it must restrict itself to the very best, then I think we need very much to collaborate with Japan, with Australia, with Singapore, with our other allies who have submarines. But I thought we needed, and I still believe we need 80. And if they're going to be, since we can't afford 80 SSNs, we ought to have 35 or 40 SSNs and 40 or 45 modern diesel submarines. We don't have to have submarines that have a test depth of 500 to 800 feet in the China Seas. They can be a lot different and a lot more attuned to that environment. So my ideal would have been a mix, as you observed, and I'm glad you did. Whether that can happen in the Navy is problematic.
Kevin Hughes.
Yes.
Oh, great. We have, speaking of which, I think his ears were burning. We have Jerry Hendricks on the line with a question. Jerry, you're on with Captain Hughes.
Yeah, I'm sorry I got in so late. Penny drug me out to see Lincoln this afternoon, and so I rushed back to try to get on before he got done. I wanted to concur with Captain Hughes, by the way, a fellow native Hoosier, that until we can identify, you know, a leader within the Navy at flag rank, you know, who can lead from the front, I think we're going to have some difficulty. But I completely concur as with him that we need essentially, you know, to grow the Navy in order to maintain presence forward. And the only way really to do that, to build up numbers, is in fact to try and find, you know, smaller variants that that allow us to purchase larger numbers at smaller cost. So I thank him for essentially being, you know, the leader in this movement for, you know, most of my adult life. And it's been a pleasure to be reading him, you know, since I was a lieutenant.
Jerry, thank you very much. Jerry comes from LaGrange, Indiana, and my mother grew up very near LaGrange, and I had an uncle and my favorite cousin grew up in LaGrange, Indiana, so it's a second home to me. I think all the best people come from the Midwest, and all the best admirals did too. Ernie King came from Ohio. Chester Nimitz came from Texas. Raymond Spruance came from Indiana. So we have a great tradition. I think the reason is because people who grew up on the sea know better than to go there, but those of us from the Midwest have this sort of romantic idea of the sea, and that's why so many great ones are Midwesterners at heart. Insofar as Jerry's thinking is concerned, I am optimistic that Admiral Greenert is going to do some good things, and I hope that Jerry, who is still in uniform, will be able to suggest some of the things that we both think are vital to our future.
Well, Captain Hughes, if I may, is there anyone that leaps out in the one-star or two-star level right now that you look to that could take the leadership in this? You know, we have yet a few more months with Undersecretary Work that these types of conversations, we know that we have an open ear there who's interested in the conversation, as you know, from the number of emails that have been exchanged between the two of you. But is there anyone that you're looking at? Because I have to say my frustration from over the last 4 years is it seems like every time that we have a place like the Irregular Warfare Office being set up, they always the individuals been placed in charge of that have always been safe company men who seem to be more interested in limiting the conversation rather than promoting the conversation of new ideas.
I regret to say I'm insulated out here. I do get to see occasionally – We do have a lot of admirals passing through here who ask questions that they need to know either before going to sea or going to Washington. And one of them was, and I can't remember his name, but Commander 7th Fleet, And I thought he had the right idea in so far as working on the China strategy. And I think he's a comer, and I hope so. I mentioned Tom Roden. He's pretty junior. He's too young to take charge of this thing. But the short answer is no. I don't have a favorite to tout to undersecretary work. And I do agree with you that he has been just one of the best undersecretaries I've seen. Even better than Jim Woolsey, who was my boss and I thought the world of.
It's just something, Jerry, I wanted to, while I have y'all, both of y'all on the line here, I'm in the process of reading Tom Rick's book, The Generals, and one of the great things about the initial part of the book is he goes over General Marshall and, you know, the Marshall model, the good and the bad. But one thing that General Marshall stressed and found so important in selecting leaders is he greatly valued flexibility of the mind, not so much somebody who was a 100-pound head genius, but somebody who had a nimble and flexible mind, which I believe is the type of individual you're talking about. As an institution, do we value the flexible mind such as General Marshall was looking for, or do we reward those that pretty much repeat what has been heard before? And are there things that we could do as an institution that could, like General Marshall did, promote that importance of the flexible mind? Jerry, we'll let you start off, and then we can go to Captain Hughes.
Okay, I'll make it really quick. I think that we undervalue critical thinking and critical thinkers in the Navy. You know, I think that the way ahead is to identify a number of key billets where you really want critical thinkers. You need to identify a career path that allows for education and thought and writing. And quite frankly, I think we need to identify what already exists, which is essentially a Navy knowledge enterprise, to use this MBA speak, which is so prevalent. But to recognize that you have things like Navy Warfare Development Center and the Academy, the War College, the Postgraduate School, and even my own institution, the Navy History and Heritage Command. And you have to somewhat create a career path that allows individuals to think and write and have promotion opportunity up and through flag rank, such that perhaps, you know, a senior thinker, you know, could end up his career as the three-star at the academy. You know, I think that the Navy hasn't valued it so far and hasn't put its money there, but, you know, we don't set out to create Mahans, or for that matter, Wayne Hughes's.
Is it my turn?
Yes, sir.
I'm going to change the angle just slightly. I was a big fan of, still am, of Raymond Spruance as our greatest. He and Arleigh Burke were the premier combat leaders in the Pacific, as far as I was concerned. And one of the things, in 19 Gun Salute, a Naval War College book, and also in a recent Naval War College review, I wrote a tribute on to Spruance's leadership. And I wound up by saying something that I think goes beyond the flexible mind adaptability. And it is that Spruance didn't strive for perfection. He didn't demand it of himself. He didn't demand it of his staff. He didn't demand of his subordinates because he said perfection will slow us down and we haven't got time. There are going to be mistakes. I remember I worked for Admiral Zumwalt twice, once when he was director of Op 96 and another one when he was CNO. And he said he was also not of the perfectionist school. He said, if you're going to make progress, you've got to make some mistakes. The Spruance attitude was, don't make big mistakes. One of the people who Spruance was taken to task by a few historians and another historian. whose name escapes me, said, yes, he made some mistakes, but when he confronted the Japanese, they always lost. And I think Spruance is calm, reflective demeanor exhibited a passion for separating molehills from mountains and making sure that he could climb all the mountains and ignoring the molehills. So that's part of this kind of capability you want to breed. It is a peacetime disease that people in all walks of life hesitate to do things because they don't want to make any mistakes. And we do probably promote people who don't make mistakes as opposed to those who might. Admiral Nimitz ran aground, and he still survived to be one of our greatest. We need to be able to sort out people who have the future ahead of them rather than people who do nothing perfectly.
Yeah.
Amen to that. And Captain Hughes, I'll tell you what, this has been an outstanding hour. I greatly appreciate you taking time to spend with us and our guests and Jerry as well, coming in and finishing up the show with some good questions. I hope both of y'all have a great Thanksgiving, and it's really been a great show. Thank you very much.
Yep. Thank you, Captain Hughes. Thank you, Jerry, for joining in.
Oh, and I just regret I didn't get here earlier. It's a good hearing from you, Captain Hughes. It's always a pleasure.
A great conversation. Thank you for asking me the right questions.
Yes, sir. It's easy to do with a guest like you.
Captain, we'd like to have you back sometime if that would be possible for you. I know we didn't get all the stuff discussed we needed to discuss with you, so anytime you'd like to come back, we'd love to have you.
Well, we'll talk about it again.
Open invitation. I want to thank everybody who joined us live today in the chat room. Some really good questions stopped Eagle One and myself from asking silly ones because y'all provided some great ones there. I hope everybody has a great Thanksgiving with you and yours. And we will see you next week as a best of, and then we'll see you later on in December. And I hope until then, everybody has a great Navy Day. Cheers.
I'm signing off.
It's a long way to Tipperary.